guys, today I'm going to read chapter 11 of Duncan's War, so here I go. Rising just visible over the southeast ridge of their meeting glen, Duncan saw the head of a fully harnessed horse, and immediately behind, the armored helmet of a dragoon lieutenant rising and falling with the motion of the horse. Within an instant, most of the horrified congregation heard that the distinctive melody of noises made a soldier mounted on a horse, creaking leather from the harness and saddle, snorting and stomping of hooves, and metallic clanking of equipment and of weapons. Every eye was fixed on the lone dragoon. All expected him to be hastily joined by the entire company of the king's soldiers, and what would follow none dared to imagine. The young lieutenant raised his horse in with a startled yank. The horse reared. Duncan thought for sure that he saw a flash of fear flicker in the young man's eyes, but it may have been only a surprise. The king's soldier blinked rapidly and seemed to say something. His horse pranced a little, and the soldier's head snapping around to keep his eyes on the band of worshippers. The muscles of his jaw worked as he clenched his teeth in indignation. Moans of dread came from several of the women. Lurching sobs rose from one woman who collapsed in a crumbled heap on the grass. Fiona's face grew paler, but she kept a firm grip on Duncan's hand and made no sound. What happened next was a story to be told many times with elaboration, though none was needed. When after a minute no other troops joined the young man, Duncan's father rightly concluded that he was sent out from the main army as a scout, an advance guard whose job it was to gather information, return, and to bring up the main body of the troops to lead them in their unexpected prey. Just as the young man looked about to turn right away, Duncan's father stepped forward and boomed after him. "Sir, we invite you to remain for the sermon." "No, we insist you remain with us for the worship of God." The soldier made no reply. "You must now know that just like your horse there, your soul is thirsty. Come join us and weep as we partake of the living water and we partake of the bread of heaven. Eat with us and be filled." The young soldier stared at Duncan's father. Then, almost reluctantly, he again began to turn his horse. "Now hear me, laddie," barked the voice of Iron Troon, one of the men stationed next to Mr. Crookshanks. "Ye'll lay the reins on your beast down, and stand with us, and stay with us for what remains of the sermon." Iron raised his musket and held it steadily on the young man. "Or sure as I eat oats, I'll shoot you dead on the spot." To give substance to the threat, he pulled back the hammer of his musket with an ominous click. The dragoon's eyes narrowed and he started to reach for his musket. "I want it if ye value your life," said Ian, his voice steady on his gun. "Carry on, Mr. Crookshanks. We have been joined by a new member of the congregation." Mr. Crookshanks resumed his sermon. "Now hear me, lad," Duncan's father whispered in Duncan's ear. "Take Broody and sneak your way up to the ridge where you can watch. The troops are not like to be far behind him. This is no play acting, Duncan. Hasty back with word the instant I see him. Now be off with you." "You'll be careful, Duncan," said Fiona, softly, her eyes pleading with him. "Aye, that I will," he replied, giving her a hand a quick squeeze. Duncan felt a surge of excitement as he scrambled through the brown heather lit on the slopes above the meeting place. His heart beat wildly. It had begun, and he was finally doing something against the English king. He paused and looked back on the circle of worshippers and the lone dragoon, his hands raised reluctantly in the air. The valley searched far below, but where Duncan lay on the ridge, he saw no troop of dragoons sweeping toward them. Looking around, Duncan spied a crag jutting above from them on the crest of the brae. "From there we'll see all, Booty." Duncan scrambled to his feet and began running up the slope, sometimes clawing with his hands on the steeper ledges. "If only I had a gun," he thought in frustration as he glanced over his shoulder at the panorama of the glam. From there, he could pick off dragoons one by one. He stopped and sighted down an imaginary musket. Blam! In his sights, he imagined a red-coated dragoon in full gallop, legs flying upward as he flipped backward off his horse. Blam! Another tumbles off and rolls down the brae, never to hunt down innocent people again. Blam! Surging sterner himself, right between his eyes. Disheartened, the remaining soldiers reined in their horses, hastily gathered their dead and wounded, and flee down the glen, galloping nonstop all the way to the Dumfries. Duncan grinned as he nodded and as he reloaded, ramming wadding down his imaginary musket, complete with sound effects. We said fear in them, Broody Eye, we did, he boasted, patting his dog affectionately on his head. Broody made no reply but crouched low, his ears at full alert. Duncan raised his musket and his eye once again, extending to give them one last volley for good measure. Suddenly, as he eyed down his thumb and the crook in his left hand, where he wished for a musket would have rested, charging around a bend came a first red-coated dragoon, and then another, until far below he saw galloping toward the field meeting, below an entire company of mountain soldiers, swords flashing and muskets at the ready. Duncan's arms fell to his sides, and he blinked several times to make sure he wasn't imagining the charging troop of thundering even closer to the unexpected worships. "They've come," he said, his voice hoarse. "They've come." Sheltered as they imagined, in the sanctuary of the meeting place, none of the worshippers could see that Duncan saw. But the lone dragoon, held at bay by Iron's troop musket, knew that it was only a matter of time. Sitting high atop his horse on the ridge above them, though it wasn't likely the first that could see them, some clank of weaponry or vibration hooves beating sound caught his attention. Duncan watched the Leontine turn his head slowly, hoping not to arouse suspicion. Then he glanced back at Iron Troon, who stood absorbed with the sermon. With a flip of his reins and driving his spurs into the sides of his horse, the young lieutenant turned and galloped toward the sounds of his approaching regiment. "We've got to sound a warning," despair in his voice, "or turn will descend like death itself." With a wrenching knot growing tighter in the pit of his stomach, Duncan feared that the soldiers would do to his family, to Fiona. He knew that they would do with Mr. Crookshanks. Suddenly, despair turned to rage. "Come on, Broody," he yelled, and plunged down the slope. Broody watched his young master fly, breakneck, down to the hill toward the congregation. Instantly, Broody sprang to his feet, but he did not follow Duncan. Like a low-flying bullet, he striked directly toward the retreating Leontine and the pursuing dragoons. Thinking Broody was at his side all the while, Duncan screamed, and he plunged toward his family, raising his hands wildly as he ran. His mother heard him first. "The lad's gang guy himself," she whispered in her husband's ear. Duncan's father looked up and saw the frantic gestures of the descending figure. "You'll not go interrupted services for nothing," he whispered to Jack. "He's sounding the alarm warning us." "A thousand pardons, Mr. Crookshanks," Duncan's father said, his loud voice interrupting the minister. "Duncan's descending, howling a warning we'd best heed or be ruined. And ye, our minister, are most in peril, preaching without consent of the bishop in defiance of the king, as we are. All ye with your arms," cried Troon, cried Iron Troon. "Check your powder. We'll give him a call of worship like none other." "Hold," boomed Duncan's father, as muskets, flintlock pistols appeared from under the plates, and the ramming and clicking, men began loading. "Hold, I say. The king's dragoons are like to be armed to the teeth. In moments they'll surround us on what that we wish." Rich, his hand swept around the grassy rim of the little sanctuary. "If any weapons visible, that man touching it would be the first to fall, and many innocents will follow. Show your weapons and we'll have a massacre. Put up your guns and we may live to see the day when we can worship peacefully." "Aye, Sandy's right," said one. We all can, one man for a man of action." Ancient cry rose above the rest. "I fought the English." He turned and sped before continuing. "I fought with them. I fought against them." He paused, looking around the little band. Women and children with anxious faces looked back at the old man. He went on. "If it were just a man, all of us armed," pulling on his beard. He fixed an eye on Duncan's father for an instant. "I'd say we make a stand, defend our rights, and do what harm we're able. But with women and all the rebearings, we defy these dragoons here in this place. We'll take one or two of us, but mark my words, defy them, and sure as I hate him, we'll all be shot." "Hear the aged," came an old woman's voice. "The grier speaks the truth," said old John Sorwick from where he sat, dejected on a large stone. "The marquee, it's all one. We're like to shoot anyhow. I wouldn't you be surprised within the hour this clan littered by our they'll be most keen to seize the minister." Duncan's father broke in firmly. "We'll best defend him by disorbing him. Begging your pardon, Mr. Crookshanks, and making him look like all the rest. In this, ancient grier speaks true. If we all look at all like armed registers of the king, we're all dead men, wives and bearings included. But our minister will die only after torture and ignominy of the worst kind." "What Sandy McKeith says is true," chimed in John Short, a butcher from the Darley. "Though I'd like nothing better than to see one of those dragoons down the barrel of my gun." If ye please, Mr. Crookshanks," pleaded Jamie's father. "We'll just fold up your gown and store it away on the rocks, and ye can mingle with the rest of us without fear and seizure." Anticipating the minister's objections, he urged, "It's not no betraying to the covenant to be prudent. Me conscience won't let me slink away at the first sign of God's enemies," said Mr. Crookshanks. "Mind ye, I've no armor for me back." "There's hardly the first sign of God's enemies for you, Mr. Crookshanks," said John Short. "Worthy Mr. Crookshanks, ye donny ken what they'll be doing to ye," said John Kilbride. We'll not aid them by sitting idle while ye do it. By this time, Duncan arrived on the rim of the meeting, and he gasped for breath, elated when he saw what was about to come upon them. 20 or 30 of the king's dragoons, he panted, coming on, fully armed. Letonian rode to meet them. He paused, scowling, and looked around for Broody. From here, he could not yet see the dragoons, but he knew from which direction they would come. They'll be here in any minute, again he glanced around for Broody. Like it is not, it's Alexander Thompson's company of the guard, offered John Short. Let loose for a new fine-raising garrison at Darley. Thompson plunders for Turner, said John McLean of the Bearscope. And like as not, this band is led by a Corporal George Deans, who plunders for Thompson. All unprincipled rabble and haters of the Kirk. I do hope your plan works, Sandy McGee. If ye go and miscuate with this sort, we like to be all doomed where we stand. Let us sing our confidence in God alone, said the minister. With that he began singing, and by ones and twos the congregation joined in. Unto the ends of the earth, and unto the ends of all the earth, wars into peace he turns. The bow he breaks, the spear he cuts, and in the fire the chariot burns. Be still, I know I am God. Duncan tried to sing, but with his eyes glued on the rise below, fearing every moment that the troops would soon descend, he couldn't join much with much heart. What's keeping them? They would have been here long ago. And where's Broody? Maybe I imagined the whole thing. After all, I was play-acting, he thought sheepishly. What if I raised alarm, this brooding service, all for no reason? He grew pale with the thought, his father's voice speaking to him and to the minister with anxious musing. Will not argue with your conscience, Mr. Crookshanks, Duncan's father stepped toward the minister, nor ask you to violate the dictates of it. He nodded at Jamie's father, who, along with several other men, fell in with him as he came to the stone pulpit. But for the sake of your continued ministry to your flock, here Duncan's father placed his arm firmly around the minister's shoulders. The other men gathered around and hoisted him down from the pulpit, removed his gown, and set him among the clustered congregation. They'll no doubt ask which one of us is God's minister, said Jamie. And my conscience compels me to answer, said Mr. Crookshanks, reluctantly, gown or no gown. Duncan ran partway back up the brae. What kept them? They're just playing cat and mouse? Or were they not really there at all? He turned, and the sight that met his eyes both thrilled and terrified him at the same time. The dragoons had halted, but not any form or rank. At least two men lay sprawled on the sod, their horses galloping back down the glen. Other horses reared and men cursed. He spotted Broody. He watched in wonder as Broody stalked and nipped at the horse's heels, retreating when he circled around like a fury and struck on their flank. Another horse flipped its rider into the sod. He rolled his red coat swirling about him until with a splash he came to rest in the ooze of a low bog. You're doing it all alone, said Duncan in amazement. But how long Broody could keep it up? The officer in charge clutched at his pistol. Duncan's blood ran cold, the ground of his teeth as he watched. The officer pointed, withdrew, aimed again, then withdrew, yanking the reins of his terrified horse in frustration. between the rearing of the horse and Rudy darting and sculling, seeming in all directions once. At once, the officer seemed unable to get off a shot, but he looked at a man to keep trying. Duncan thought, his face pale and drawn as he watched. "What's he, ye lad?" he heard someone faintly shouting from below. It sounded like the ancient crier. Duncan hated to take his eyes off Rudy, but just as he was about to yell a reply, the first time he felt a tinge of real fear. What if the sharp-eyed dragoon, angered from Rudy's aversion? What if he heard Duncan's yell a reply and then spotted him up on the brae? Could a carefully aimed shot hit him from down there? And just what would lead a bullet feel like when it crashed into his arm or leg or chest? He shuddered, turned, and fled down the hill to deliver his reply to the closer range. "Rudy's holding them off," he panted, his voice breaking with emotion and with the strange of it all. "He's doing it alone. We'll scatter to the mist then," said Iron Troon, "and pick off one or two English up from the brae." "I'll none of your talk, Iron," said Duncan's father severely. "We scatter now to the barren brae, lonely and open as it is, and they'll be doing the picking off, shooting your bearings and mine, and asking questions later. Perhaps when none can answer. No, we'll sit together and hide the minister, trusting God for our protection. Don't be looking to the hills, man. Look rather to the Lord." And then a pistol shot cracked. It shattered off and fell toward the glen. To Duncan, a restore from that pistol seemed to echo and re-echo on and on. Its crack and whistle seemed settled into a wailing that Duncan never forgot. With a scream of rage, Duncan felt his feet pounding onto the rim of the meeting glen. He heard his own screams as if they came from someone else. As he rounded the ridge, intending to plunge down the brae toward Rudy and the dragoons, a sound of the pistol, he stumbled. Apparently sensing that her brother, in his rage, was about to do, and knowing the peril if he did, Fiona gathered up her skirts and raced toward him, hoping to cut him off the low side of the ridge before he plunged farther down into the jaws of the dragoons. She clutched at him as he rose, his knee bleeding from the sharp stones on which he fell. "Duncan, ye canny go," she said firmly, but with tears in her eyes. "They'll only kill ye." "But they've killed Rudy," he sobbed. "They've killed him. If they kill the lad's dog," John's short voice rose from among the worshippers, "they'd like to be on us any moment." "Duncan," called his father sharply, "take Fiona and scatter to the mist. There'll be no time for ye to join us. Stay hidden with her on the brae." Duncan, his face striped with sweat and tears, hesitated. "Do it now," boomed his father's voice. Duncan looked at Fiona's pale face and seemed to be awakened. He knew that if he tried to run up the brae with Fiona, she would not be able to go as fast, and he'd be spotted sooner by the dragoons. He grabbed her hand and traversed along the brae to a large stone surrounded by the tangle of a brown heather. Meanwhile, protesting that he must answer if asked, Mr. Crookshanks was positioned so as to be completely surrounded by his congregation, and several women and children were ordered to sit on him. This both hid him and from the combined weight of those seated on him, pressed enough to utter would come out only indomitable little wheezes. "Trust in God," someone called out. "Jehovah will fight for us." Others joined in, but still faces were pale and eyes were wide. and as the pounding of hooves and clanking of dragoons thundered ominously toward them. Duncan and Fiona lay within earshot, hunkered behind a rock, peering through the heather, his breath coming in angry sobs. Duncan watched as the dragoon circled the meeting place with clipped precision. He scanned the ridges and depressions. No sign of Ruby. He took a small comfort in the appearance of several of the men, besmeared with ooze of the bogs, and grass and mud stains striking the white trousers of several others. A muddy pair of red-faced soldiers dog-trotted after, apparently unable to retrieve their horses, ordered to follow on foot. "Present," ordered the captain. For a horrifying instant, Duncan thought he was about to order the men to fire down on the whole congregation. "Who's in charge of this military band of psalm-singing traitors?" he barked, scanning the faces. Duncan thought he detected a hint of lilt and a roll here and there. He wondered he might not be a Scot to doing his best to put an English accent in his ears. "I demand an answer," said the captain ordered, looking at each of the men in turn. A sneer derision twisted in his mouth. No one spoke. A light lifting on the seat on which several of the women sat. A muffled grunt went undetected by the captain. "Perhaps a search of you would presume to call yourselves men," he went on, his chin extended in contempt. "Perhaps such a search might yield an ill-kept pistol or two. Not that any of you would be proficient at firing such. We have no fear of that pathetic little band of gutter slime that you obviously are." He sniffed the air, wrinkled his nose in disgust, and held a lace handkerchief in his face, taking deep breaths of its scented folds. "There, I am restored." Several of his men dutifully snickered at his mocking humor. I say, if I were to uncover a weapon of two among you, I would feel unjustly threatened." Here, with brow lift, the feigned a hurt expression, and held his hand over his heart in mock offense. "And to threaten the king's man is to threaten the king himself. If I would naturally have to, well, to shoot you dead on the spot. Now come then, who will be first in our little search?" "He's beating them," hissed Duncan. Iron troops never a man for insult. He'll stand up to them and die on the spot if he does," whispered Fiona in return. The captain looked at his lieutenant before continuing. The young officer nodded toward Iron Troop. "You with a red face, about to burst a button." He pointed his drawn sword toward Iron. "What is that wrapped up in your filthy blade? Perhaps it's your coward of a minister. I demand an answer." More grunts came from where the woman sat. Duncan's father caught Ian's eye and defied him to vent his anger. And a hothead like Ian would get the entire congregation shot. Iron ground his teeth together and turned a darker red. His eyes flashed with rage at the captain who taunted him. "I wish I had a gun," hissed Duncan through gritted teeth. "A muckle big one." "If you were shot to shoot these," said Fiona, more would come in their place, who would then shoot more of us. Rather, always says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. That's what always Father says. That's from the Bible, Fiona. Hissed Duncan, disgusted that she would attribute it to their father. I can it, Duncan, but sometimes I worry that you've forgotten it's from the Bible. Duncan looked at his sister in wonder. The captain was speaking again. All right, then, he said. If you'll not give it up peacefully, he broke off with a sturdy nonchalance. He gazed at the reflection in his polished blade of his sword. He breathed on the blade, slowly wiped it on his sleeve. Squinting critically, he moistened his finger, turned to one side for a better look, and smoothed his eyebrows. Coolly, without taking his eyes from his reflection, he said to the young Lithuanian at his side, "Shoot him." So that was chapter 11. Bye, guys. See you later. See you later. See you later. See ya. See ya later. Bye, guys.